Hey everyone, this is Kabe from the House of Pod. I'm here with
Lizzie.
And if you haven't heard our show before, we're a medical
sort of
podcast. And today we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to talk about accepting gifts from patients.
We're going to talk about how to deliver bad news.
And we'll also talk about options for sedation with surgeries and procedures. Stay tuned.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
How are we doing today, guys?
Wonderful. Wonderful. It's been a wonderful day.
Wow. Super convincing.
I know. I'm like...
I'm dying on the inside, Kaveh.
You can see right through me.
Yeah. Joe, are you faring any better?
Super duper happy.
Go on.
Wow, that's also not convincing.
I know.
And Kaveh's on call, so we know that he's not excited either.
Well,
so
I actually am excited. You know why? Because I have the next 3 Mondays off.
Why?
I took 2 days off because I have like about 2 years of vacation accrued, and not literally, but...
well done, buddy.
Yeah, but I have a lot of vacation. I'm like, you know what? I hate Mondays. I'm going to take 3 in a row off. Why not? Darn it.
Sure, yeah.
So I don't have to go to work tomorrow after this nice, beautiful recording session. I'm going to go fishing tomorrow. I haven't been fishing in about a year.
Where do you go fishing?
Well, my top secret spot, I don't tell anybody. It kicks butt.
His bathtub. I'm like, that doesn't sound like a truth.
Wait, tell us.
Okay.
Can you give us a general region?
Well, I go to Livermore. There is a beautiful lake called Los Vaqueros Reservoir. They have a nice marina with boats you rent. Gorgeous lake, and it connects to the delta, which connects to the ocean. So you get all kinds of crazy fish like striped bass.
Mm-hmm. Sharks.
Did you just say striped bass?
Striped bass. It's not striped bass, striped bass. That's how you pronounce it.
Wait, is that for real?
Is he serious?
Yeah, stripers.
Can a listener please call or email us to let us know if Joe is full of shit?
I've never heard anyone say, I got some striped bass. It's striped bass.
Every time I eat it, I say striped bass.
Can I tell a Joe story real quick? Can I tell a Joe? Then we'll get to the medical stuff. So this is like our first year of college. Joe and I were on a double date, and we went to like a Mexican restaurant. And it was one of the best. It was like a really nice Mexican restaurant. This is one of my favorite Joe stories. And we all take our orders. I got like the, I don't know, enchiladas. And then someone else got like taco, whatever. And it comes to Joe, and he goes, I'll get your burrito plate here. And the woman looks at him for a second. She's like, what? Your burrito plate. And she's like, you mean the burrito plate?
And he's also saying it with an Italian accent. He's like, you're a burrito plate.
There is one thing I have to say in my defense 20 years later. Please note that most of the menu was in Spanish. happened to throw a couple of English words in there, and it just confused me.
Totally true.
I've been hearing about it ever since.
So something sort of closely medically related.
What's that? Burrito? E. coli?
So, close. So a patient did something nice the other day, brought in a box of cookies.
Homemade cookies?
Homemade cookies as sort of a thank you. Like, thank you for being our doctor and for doing the awesome job that I'm known to do, right?
So it's personal. It was for you, Kaveh.
For me. But then I was, and I want to talk about this a little bit, because the question is, what can you accept from patients? Because clearly, as we've discussed before, and we were talking about this offline, about how, you know, there are certain cultures that can give money gifts. For example, you had mentioned
for Chinese New Year. People definitely give like red envelopes with cash in it. And we've definitely gotten emails that are like, beware, this is going to happen. And I don't think you're really allowed to accept it.
Well, that makes sense to us, right? I mean, money makes sense. But then the part of me was like, well, can I accept these cookies? And then there's another part of me that was like, why can't I accept cookies? What kind of world are we living in where I couldn't accept cookies as a thank you? Like, that to me seems crazy that I have to question that.
Cookies are better than money.
Agreed.
So if you think about it that way, and you're not allowed to accept cash, you can't accept the wonderful, delicious cookies.
Well, I'm not going to say whether or not I accepted them. but I am going to say it is an interesting thing. So maybe when we have an ethicist come on the show, we can talk to them about that.
Oh, cookies. Okay, right. I'm writing down cookies, and I won't understand what that note means.
She's actually scribbling something down right now.
I wrote
now,
down cookies. I swear to God.
All right. How about we take a little break, and then we come back with an email?
Cool.
To the House of Pod. We're going to read an email now. And if anyone has an email or a question for us, please email us at hopquestions@gmail.com. Questions with an S at the end. That's for Joe. hopquestions@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail. Nobody will answer, I promise. Just call and leave a voicemail. The number is
408-444-6623.
Okay. This is an email actually from a nurse that we work with, Diane. I'm not sure if that's, you know, we did not solicit this. It was very sweet of her to email. She writes, "Hi guys, I really enjoy the shows and the topics discussed. Having Joe on as one of the hosts is great because he lends a perspective from one who's not a physician. His questions and comments are insightful."
Wow.
Have you read this yet, Joe?
I have not. This is a total shock to me, and I am completely flattered.
Totally unsolicited. I just wow. That's for you. My favorite episode was the fourth with the VA doctor as a guest. That was Raja.
Shout out to Raja. Hey, buddy.
And though I've watched Scrubs and enjoyed it, I was unaware that it was so close to being a realistic portrayal of what interns and residents go through and what they think. Now, my question, how do doctors deliver bad news to a patient, especially if it involves cancer? Does a patient's age matter? What's your thought process? I've always wondered about this. Do you guys have a patient that stands out in your own personal experience? And I look forward to your next episode.
That's a great question.
It is. Thank you.
That's a real tough one, I would think, as a doctor. I'm anxious to hear what you guys say.
I thought about this a little bit. And pretty much every clinical doctor at some point has to give bad news. It's not always necessarily cancer. It can be anything from an outpatient doctor, a family practice doctor, or a sports doctor talking to, say, a guy who's an athlete or a woman who's an athlete and telling them that they have an injury that they may not 100% recover from. That's bad news.
Or that they need surgery.
It's life-changing, or it needs surgery. And then it ranges from that all the way up to, say, you have metastatic incurable cancer. So this is something that every clinical doctor pretty much has to go through. I don't know if anesthesiologists and radiologists get away without this, but for the most part, I can think every clinical doctor does. And then in my experience, patients, they want to know the news, whether it's good or bad. Not every patient wants to know the prognosis as much. And that is sort of where it comes down to tailoring it for the patient.
Yeah.
Not every patient wants to know what their prognosis is, but you can kind of get a sense of that from your initial discussion with the patient. And my strategy is to find a sort of a quiet area if you can, in person, it's better than over the phone, and talk to them, use straightforward language, try to avoid using unnecessary medical jargon if you can. And that's hard for us because I think we fall back on that without even thinking about it, because it's like a safety net for us to start using terms like, oh, well, your EGD showed this and the CEA was this. And
the biggest problem for terminology, in my experience, especially I've realized in the last few months, is tumor, mass, cancer. Those are all, lesion. These are all almost synonymous, and not really. Like, lesion means we don't know what it is. But if you say tumor, people, not everyone knows that that means cancer. You really do have to be very explicit. I think using the C word, cancer, yeah. which our parents' generation, you know, I'd ask my dad, what did your dad die from? He's like the big C. Like nobody used to talk about it, you know?
Right.
So you have to be very, very clear. Like Kaveh said, no jargon. And I think, you know, you said also do it in person versus phone. I think
if
that's ideal, right? Yeah. But if it were me and someone tells me, I think you have cancer, I took a bunch of biopsies, I'll let you know. I want to know as soon as possible.
Right.
I don't want to come in next week. I want you to call me tomorrow if you get the answer tomorrow. So I definitely have had phone conversations. But again, I will prepare them when I see them. I think you have cancer. I will know for sure with the biopsies. But even if the biopsies are normal, we still have to treat this as cancer until we're sure.
And for me, how I like to do that conversation, and I'm curious to know how you do it too, but the way I like to do it is I like to start by sort of saying, getting a sense of how much they know about what's happening, how much they know about the disease that might be affecting them, how much they know about the tests that have been done. So, you know, start, for example, by being like, have you heard the results of your CT scan, or what's your familiarity with what's going on? Getting a sense of that's the first thing. And you have to give clear plans, just like you said, give clear evidence, and you have to give pauses too. Because once you say things like mass or possible cancer, even if it's just a possibility, once you say that, it's like static. Yeah. Like all they hear is static.
The best thing is for them to have a family member or friend there as well and give them maybe an email or a piece of paper, because they will. Like it's not, people are not going to hear anything but like what Kaveh said with static. Mm. And the one thing with, again, with us, and what I think the cancer that you and I probably find the most is colon cancer. Again, fortunately, another safety net, that's one of the more curable ones that we've talked about. Whereas we also find pancreatic cancer probably once or twice a year. And that is not, you know, it's the prognosis is much worse. So it's harder. You know, I definitely have had those conversations. And it really is a fine line between giving somebody hope and just being really realistic. Because you want to do both. You know, you're not done. You're not giving up on them. You can't, you know, the whole concept of abandoning a patient, even if they're going to die. You can't ever let them think that you're abandoning them because then they're just hopeless, you know? But again, you can't say that there's a lot of hope and a lot of like great outcomes. And it's just, it's a fine line between honesty, directness, and then that level of hope that you need, you know, to live.
I think it's really important to do it honestly, but whenever possible to do it with optimism. Yeah. And that is a fine line to sort of do. I mean, you want to outline plans and options with them, and I'll do that, but you certainly can't expect people to make decisions right then because, you know, it's too hard. That's like you said, some people kind of know it. They have this sense of it, but even then it's hard. Once you hear that, it's hard to, like, you watch Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
I thought that when the first episode or something, when he's diagnosed with the cancer, I thought that was a really great, like, depiction of it.
I don't remember.
Because he's there so talking to the oncologist, and the oncologist tells him what happens, and then his voice kind of fades away, and the voice becomes distant, and all he focuses on is this mustard stain on the guy's shirt.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just like, that's, you have a stain there on your shirt. Because it's like, it's too hard for the brain to accept that sometimes. Right. It's hard. It requires a little time. It's a tough thing for us to do, and you have to sort of prepare for emotions from the patient.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be the case. Sometimes it's totally outward, open emotions. Like they'll start crying. That can happen. And sometimes it can be more subtle. Like they can ask questions like, you know, they'll be like, why this happened to me? What did I do to deserve this? Or what, how long do I have to live? You can sense the fear in there, and you got to sort of address those emotions.
Right. They say, why me? And they'll also ask you questions like, how long do you think it's been growing there? You know, to sort of try to understand and get power.
Because
I think you feel so powerless. And I'm like, and I don't want to say this, and I never do, but it doesn't really matter how long it's been growing. You know, it's sort of like, you know, they're looking for reasons. And I think that encourages guilt. Like, oh, it's probably been there 3 years. Oh, then they're going to say, oh, I should have gotten my colonoscopy 3 years ago. And I would hate to encourage that, you know?
What do you do to stop that? That's a great point. I never thought of that. But that I could, if that's handled wrong, that could completely destroy someone emotionally.
The thing I try to tell these people is, you know, there are things that we do to put our bodies at risk. There are habits that we do that increase your risk of developing certain cancers. And getting screening is a good way to fight cancer. you know. But the truth of it is, most of these people, it's not like they're doing anything wrong. They didn't do anything to deserve it. And that's something I actually tell them. I'm like, you didn't do anything to deserve this, you know. And that, I do believe, is the truth. Even if they missed, say, a screening, which I hope nobody does.
I never rub it in their face. Yeah. Yeah. At the point that you're talking to them about cancer, it doesn't matter. Right. And I say, I don't know how long it's been growing. You know, let's just talk about the next step. Like, I try to move forward because I don't want people wallowing in guilt and self-doubt. And
so stuff. You could handle it a way like that to minimize the guilt.
If they want to, they're going to bring it back to that always. But I don't want to encourage
not
that.
Not relevant, so why even go there, I guess? I don't know.
The hardest patients are the ones who you're like, you have... We also diagnose liver cancer a lot, our cirrhotics, our Hep B patients. You know, a lot of them... I don't know why, but they're like, they're always so nice about it. And I find that that's the hardest for me to deal with. The patients are just like, oh, thank you. So, okay. Well, thanks for letting me know. I'm like, you understand, right? And they're like, no. Yeah, no, it's fine. No, but thank you. You've been so great. And I'm like, when they start complimenting me, it makes me feel so, I'm like, you should be angry. You should be angry at me. You should be angry at the world.
Because there is that part of that is just like, you're thinking maybe they're not getting this.
Yeah.
And that's
totally
important. Right, you know?
But, and then I realize that they are, and then they're just so sweet or can't handle it right now. And I sort of want people to be a little angrier. I don't know. There's something, it's just hard to sort of manage because you're expecting anger and guilt and sadness. And then there's just like nice people.
These patients that we have that we see go through this are some of the most amazing sort of examples of courage. It just, the way they handle it with grace sometimes, and a lot of times, it's just, I find it really inspiring. But it is, it's a tough conversation to have, and it wears on people. You talk to oncologists, people who do this for like a living, they'd see a lot more of this. I mean, it wears on them. I'm sure that's a big part of their burnout. It's just those conversations, because it's hard. You have to compartmentalize things as a doctor sometimes. But that is hard to do sometimes. And I'll admit, like, there's been times where I've been talking to a patient and I've been telling them that I've been telling them bad news, and it gets me, like, while I'm in the middle of it. It's hard to separate yourself from it.
And then, so Diane's last point is, are there any patients that stand out? And I mean, the ones I remember the best are the youngest ones, really, the ones who are, it wasn't even on my list. You know, when you do a procedure and you're like, oh, colon cancer's on the list. I don't think you have it, but it's on the list.
Yeah.
And then you do a procedure on a 40-year-old or a 45-year-old and you find something like colon or rectal cancer. And when that's not even on my top, like, 3, 4, 5 on the differential, it's always there. You know, anytime someone comes to you with abnormal sort of symptoms from their routine, it's on the list. But when you go that far down, and it's just a surprise, I just remember it because it's so much, it's always hard, but it's so much harder to tell a young person that you weren't expecting colon cancer when and you found it.
Yeah.
I don't tell patients that. I'm not like, I'm very surprised. Like, that's not anything anyone wants to hear.
Right.
But that happens.
That is hard.
I think of 2 or 3 right now off the top of my head who are less than 45, and then those stick with me.
And part of that is because you see yourself in there.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be like a young guy, like I say, a young dad with like kids. I'm like, oh my God, it wrecks me. It's hard. It's a tough thing to do. But like, I think as a doctor, you have to take a little bit of pride in the way you deliver bad news. That is as much a part of medicine and being a good doctor as like doing a great surgery or procedure.
Or delivering good news.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, oh, your procedure was totally normal. Like, you should be able to do all that equally well. It's hard. I mean, it's a great question. I think that everybody will have a different perspective and can remember patients who, I remember Bellevue 10 years ago, you know, a patient in the ICU for weeks, maybe months, died, you know, and it wasn't that big of a surprise when somebody lives in the ICU for that many weeks. When they die, it's not going to be the most shocking event in the entire world, right? They've already been very sick. The whole family just started wailing, like 10 people, a very big family, just to the point where everyone was just very uncomfortable, but that's how they showed their expression, you know, and you didn't have to give the bad news. It was right there, but everyone expresses, you know, sadness and anger, you know, in different ways.
Yeah. And they sort of train you a little bit for that in medical school. They try to as best they can. Sometimes schools will have like actors come in and they'll act out the scene and you'll sort of like, that's always a bit weird. It's always a bit
super. It made me feel so uncomfortable.
It's super weird because it's clearly an actor. But, you know, it's good to learn some of the dialogue because some of that stuff you do need to use. You need to be able to fall back on some sort of some deep training that you have in the back of your head when things get really weird and stressful. You need to have something, some dialogue you can turn to. And it is useful for that.
It is good because it's so awkward. And some actors go in there sort of knowing they're going to try to, like,
I know,
piss you off.
And they're going to, oh, we should do that to Joe. We should make Joe be the doctor and do a role play with us right now like we did in medical school.
I was going to say we should just do the podcast and be like, Joe, you stink. Set it up faster. Edit faster.
Do
and
what we
just,
do.
Like, whatever, gaslight him. Yeah. Make him think that we're just, you know, something's going on.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. You know what, though? I'm actually glad that they trained you guys a little bit or tried to. That's really important on that topic because not medical related. It's more, what's the word?
It's human.
It's the art. Human the art and science.
Treating the psychological part of it, I guess. But that's really important because there's a lot of doctors who might be technically great, but just horrible with the communication.
It's the concept of a bedside manner, which a lot of it is just instinctive. And I think that if you try, you can teach it. But it's just like your personality and how patient you are and how clear you are. But I think obviously some people like Kaveh excel more than most.
Word. It is something you have to practice. I'm sure the first couple times I had to do it in my training were not great.
Yeah.
Like I don't know for sure. I'd have to like really think back to it, but I'm sure I went in there really trying to overemphasize the positives and trying to downplay things
right.
and being a little too Pollyanna-esque about it because
right.
that's so much safer to you to do that. It's
it
so
is.
More, you know.
We want to only give good news. So I do think that that's a rookie mistake that we all probably do is where we're like, you have cancer, but it's probably going to be fine. And you don't know. You should never say like, it's probably going to be fine. You're probably going to get a surgery and get cured if you literally have no idea. So anyway, I think that we...
Covered that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Thank you, Diane. We're very appreciative for the positive words as well. So thanks again.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. We are going to talk about an article from the New York Times from March, the end of March 2017, that they were talking about how with patients having more say in their care and being less paternalistic in medicine, which is sort of the wave, you know, if you talk to our parents who might be doctors, who may be trained in the 70s and 80s, it was really a doctor-run business, let's say. The doctor says this, you do what they say, but now it's much more of a sort of a partnership, if you will, and a discussion. And on other podcasts, we've talked about how you're sort of also trying to please patients because there is a component where now people are being reimbursed based on patients' opinions of you and how that poses challenges. And this article talks about asking patients what they think as far as what kind of sedation or anesthesia they get for surgery and trying, and some patients want to stay awake. And this whole, you know, the article talks about, you know, where the line is and what we should be doing and as far as patient opinions with sedation. Do we do local anesthetics and make something numb, like if you're going to get wrist surgery? Women who give birth all the time who get these quote-unquote epidurals, which are spinal taps, it's a local nerve block, so they're actually awake. You've seen movies, TV shows, or you've had it yourself.
Well, the obvious question is it safer and less risky to have it done during awake, or is that a patient myth?
Difference between an epidural or local is general anesthesia, G-E-T-A, right? General
anesthesia, GA.
Yeah, but we
You're thinking Grand Theft Auto.
Oh, tracheal interface, right.
GTA, that's different.
Oh, sorry, right. I'm like, I don't know. I don't get the joke. Explain it to me.
So the article was about, in particular, about surgery and patients opting to stay awake and not be asleep for it, which is like, just like Lizzie was saying, part of this new wave of patient autonomy. I had a lot of mixed emotions about it when I read it, because I understand certainly some people are just curious and they want to see what's going on. They're medically curious. But there is another sort of faction of these people who are suspicious of the medical community,
yeah,
who want to be awake. These are probably similar people who keep their phones on record, like during procedures when they're in the doctor's office, because they want to make sure that the doctor isn't saying or doing something bad. And
we can talk about that, but there was a lawsuit that we talked about 2 years ago.
Yeah, let's get back to that. But to sort of get to Joe's question, is it safer? In some ways, yes. In some studies, like in fact, this article, this New York Times article talks about, you know, they pulled some research from Hand, which is a journal of hand surgery, to look at this particular question of carpal tunnel release. And they took like 100 patients who had the typical surgery, which is with IV sedation. They slept through the thing. And then they took like 100 patients who were awake and had a local like nerve block. And at the end of the day, they found that the people who had the local required less pain medication. They were able to go home earlier. So in some ways, yeah, it's good. But that study also showed that pretty much whatever way you do, you leave liking it. So 93% of people who had the general sedation or the IV sedation, they would say they would do that again. And 93% of people who had the local said they would do that again.
Which just suggests that when the patients participate in their care,
right,
they're happier.
Right.
Or they stay happy, or you don't disappoint. And, you know, Kaveh and I have this experience with sedating people. We don't use general anesthesia for most of our procedures. We use what we call conscious sedation, or some people call it twilight, where it's like, you know, you get truth serum, you know, quote, that's like a TV movie thing, but it is Versed and fentanyl are the two most common medications we use when we're not using anesthesia assistance. And patients are sort of, you know, it's like they're really deep sleep, you know, and you can say, sir, can you move over? And they'll maybe move a little bit. And patients sometimes come in for a colonoscopy and say, I want to stay awake. And it's a long discussion. It's much harder to say no than to say as we've talked about, where I'll say, you know, I do this all the time, and the thing that I do the most commonly is really what you want, which is sedation. But if you really need to get to work today, or, you know, maybe they've had a bad experience, or maybe their mom just went in for surgery last week and died, and they have all these preconceived thoughts about it, I do it probably twice a year, like colonoscopies without any sedation. And the patient's watching the whole time, and it's really about their pain tolerance as well. And the few times I've done it, people are really... if they come in saying, I want no sedation, they often do very well and they're watching. But you do in the room with me and the nurses, you really have to watch what you say. And it does distract from what I'm doing, because I'm constantly talking to the patient and wondering if they have questions, and it becomes a conversation, you know?
Yeah, that's right. It can throw off the feel of the operating room or the procedure room. Like if a patient's like asking a bunch of tough questions, not even tough questions, or if they're asking a bunch of questions, like while you're in the middle of a difficult procedure, then that can be distracting. And that's something that we have to sort of learn how to address, is like how, and that's something that's going to change, I think, in time with medicine, is we can't talk the same way we normally would. And you can't, when a patient's in the middle of something, you have to be comfortable telling them, hey, hold your questions for a second while I do this very difficult maneuver.
Yeah.
And that's weird too, because that requires like a level of sort of social tact while you're doing a procedure that's, you know, requiring a lot of like coordination and has your facilities, you know, fully at task. So it is something that I think will keep changing. But to get back to the risk thing again, there's certainly still risks. And that's one of the problems I had with this article, is I think it kind of gives this general sense that, like, look, the doctors, she even uses the term like paternalistic in it. She's like, the doctors just don't want to do this because it's easier. I don't think she says that, but I think
the
some people are going to feel that.
The doctors don't want to keep you awake because it's easier
to keep you asleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that certainly isn't the key, because there's certain risks without being sedated. There's certain risks if you're awake. Still, if you get a local, or if you get, say, a spinal, there's risks with that. You can still have cardiac risks.
Yeah.
You still have even the worst case scenario, you know, paralysis or that sort of thing with those epidurals. So there's still risks. In some surgeries, some procedures, you need to be completely asleep.
Right.
The muscles need to be completely relaxed or paralyzed. And there are sometimes when this might make the anesthesiologist's job a lot harder, is my point. That patients are going to read this article and they're going to like go in for their surgery the next day and be like, so can I be awake for this thing? And if the anesthesiologist is like, I don't recommend that, then they're going to be like, well, you're being paternalistic. Mm-hmm.
Well,
you're telling
me
what to do.
Yeah, it's not necessarily, when people say, oh, they want to put you totally to sleep general and not local, and they say it's easier, what they should say, it's just more routine, which, by the way, routines are easier. You know, if you have the same pattern, the same workflow as everyone at work sort of uses that term, and the same kind of, okay, come in the room, sedate, procedure. You know, if I mess up, I can say to the nurse, oh, no, crap, I didn't get that entire polyp. Let's go back. I can't, you know, I don't do a bad job, but I can be sort of more myself. And another thing, you know, I will start off if a patient's wide awake saying, don't be offended if I ignore you. It just means I'm focusing on your procedure. And everyone wants a good procedure. And the other sort of question that this reminds me of is when patients come with family members and they say, can my family members come in the room? I don't know about you, 100% say no. I'm like, this is something that you don't know how you're going to respond to. What if you get nervous? Then I get nervous. Everyone in the room that I'm working with is nervous.
It's a stage fright environment that's not needed.
And I honestly think I would be fine, but I'm like, I can't speak for the nurses I work with. I don't want them wondering if you're staring at them and like judging them. I want them to do the best that they can do. And somebody, a third party, you know, family member.
Not a good thing in any way I can think of.
I don't know if it's policy, but I definitely say I do not want that.
I think it is policy, but I totally agree. It's the same reason why somebody should never operate on their loved one.
Yeah.
Because there has to be, if there's something happening, if there's an emergency, if you have to be able to think objectively. And it's harder to do that if there's someone in the room who you can sense behind you is getting nervous, is freaking out. Or what if they, you know, get panicked and they get sweaty and vasovagal and they faint?
Yeah.
And then you're dealing with two patients. That certainly happens sometimes when people are delivering babies. So I think overall, I agree, even if it wasn't policy, which I'm pretty sure it must be, but even if it wasn't, it's not a good idea to have family members in the room.
Yeah. And with the general anesthesia, there are studies that say the longer the procedure, the more sedation, like there are associated memory losses. You know, people are very worried about that stuff. Yeah. And some of it's legitimate. Our procedures are usually 20, 30, 40 minutes. I don't actually think it's a huge concern. But people read a lot of this stuff and bring it to the office or the OR or whatever. And you do have to address them. I mean, the point of the story is have a conversation with the patient and talk about the risks and benefits.
I think the whole concept is interesting, and I'm actually for it. The whole concept behind this is sort of the demystification of medicine. It's like what we talked about in this show, like the House of Pod. You're pulling back the curtain on medicine and seeing what it really is. And that, I think, is sometimes really good. I love talking to patients while they're doing the procedures, if they can handle it, if it's not too painful for them, if they're not uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It can work, but sometimes it's not going to be a good option.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, you know, people read articles like this and they don't necessarily pull that from the article.
Yeah.
So I have a question.
Yes, Joe.
Go on.
You have a question.
I'm just blanking.
Okay, well, Joe just asked Kaveh and I a question.
This is what happens when I don't use notes in these shows.
Is this what you just asked it 2 seconds ago? This is what happens when you get less than 11 hours of sleep. This is what Joe's question was literally 45 seconds ago now. And he said, with respect to general sedation versus local, is there a chance, is there a real risk with general sedation? For example, he's heard or read, not on NPR, that you can maybe not wake up if you get general sedation.
Or any sort of complication. There's always a risk of complication if someone is out. Is it safer if they're not out with that risk?
I mean, for as far as like respiratory-wise, 100%. If you get intubated, there's, you know, a piece of foreign object in your trachea helping you breathe, or a mask, you know, that's introducing air to put you on a ventilator. So you're not breathing. If you're totally paralyzed and sedated, you're not breathing. So yeah, if there's all those complications, what if you sort of put it down the wrong tube? What if there's swelling and you can't breathe well when you take it out? You know, there's all these risks. And what if you don't wake up? Sure, there's risks. But then you also have to balance it out with local sedation. What if you wake up, or what if you're awake and watching it and you're totally traumatized, or you start moving around and the surgeon or colonoscopist, if you will, endoscopist messes up? What if that happens? You know, you have to balance everything out.
Yeah.
And also, like we said, what if you're wide awake and you start asking questions and you make the doctors or nurses or other ancillary staff nervous? You know, that's like all these things, and maybe it's not a mess up, but maybe it's just not perfect, you know, or as perfect as it could be. There's all these nuances that I don't know that we can measure, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a
those
good question.
Great points.
I think at the end of this discussion is that there are times when it can be appropriate and you need to have that discussion with your doctor. And there's some procedures, surgeries, and when it's not. And I don't think it's a paternalistic attitude if the anesthesiologist or the doctor is to say, look, I don't think this is the right thing for you to do. So, but it is a discussion that you can have with your doctor or your anesthesiologist. Maybe what we can do at some point is have an anesthesiologist on. I'd like to talk to them about that. Because imagine if you're an anesthesiologist and someone comes up to you and says, I'm going to have this 3-hour-long surgery and I do not want to be asleep for it. I want to be awake. You can, and there's a way to do that with locals. The anesthesiologists are actually pretty good about doing that if they can. You're there with the anesthesiologist. That's really who you are standing with the whole time, because you know, you're not going to see for the most part what the surgeons are seeing. You're sort of there. Your head is usually right there next to the anesthesiologist. And that person has to like talk to you for like 3 hours. And
yeah.
The whole time you're like, what's that beep? What's that boop? What's this?
Right.
What's that? The anesthesiologist has to sort of be able to talk to you through that the whole time and keep you calm and to sort of redirect you. And that's not really something they teach you in medical school, you know?
That's a great point, actually.
Or the patient looks at the anesthesiologist and says, hey, do you have an extra crossword puzzle that I can borrow?
Right.
Or a newspaper article. I mean, honestly, I think the length of time absolutely will dictate a recommendation. I don't think 3, 4, 5 hours. I don't think anyone would say, yeah, stay awake for that.
And also, sometimes the patient is going to be in really uncomfortable positions.
Right.
They have to be for the surgery, and that's a long time to be awake in an uncomfortable position.
And what if you tell the patient it'll be about 3 hours, and then it's 1 hour? They're like, oh my God, they took a shortcut. Or it's 6 hours. Oh my God, there must be something hard. Like, it's just, I can't imagine being awake for that.
I would think it could possibly be well used in more simple, quicker surgeries, but maybe anything over 40 minutes or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
we could
Joe's
get
a prescription solution here, but.
We could get an anesthesiologist, and we also could ask friends or family or listeners to call with a personal experience, you know, because people will have, you know, sort of recommendations.
I would be out every time. If they could put me out during a dental cleaning visit, I'd say, put me out, baby.
Right.
I hate it.
All right. We'll be right back with more House of Pod.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. We are going to read another email out loud and hopefully
out loud
as opposed to in my head.
I prefer sign language.
And I read this, and I know from our last email that you have not been reading them, Joe. So this one maybe you should tackle, but I'll read it first.
from
your personal experience.
Can we have him read it? I think.
Sure.
No, why don't you go ahead and read it? I'll respond.
Okay. Let Dr. Joe do this.
Actually, I have read it. I have perused the emails, and there's several. Again, thank you, everybody, for emailing. And this one in particular, I think you and I might have the same amount of experience. So here, this is from Steven. Hey, guys. I love the House of Pod so far. A quick question. I enjoy ass play, and I was inspired by your episode titled Butt Stuff. But I thought that there would be more on ass play. So I want to know, when engaging in ass play... would you recommend using a dildo or a fist?
Wait, first I want to thank Steven. Steven?
Yeah, Steven.
I want to thank...
No last name, shockingly.
I want to thank him for listening, for taking the time to email. And I respect that he was willing to put this into an email and ask us a question. I'd much rather he talk to somebody about this sort of stuff than do it on his own, or to do it without some sort of knowledge going into this sort of thing.
I mean, my guess is from this email, he's experienced enough that he's probably tried both. So he wants to know what we as experts, Joe, would recommend. And I guess, you know,
I'm an expert in this area, possibly.
Okay.
Not due to experience, but...
just all the thought you've given to it?
Yeah. What I've read...
On butt play.
I would say this. I would ask him a question back and say, well, it depends. Do you have more sensation you know, from something vibrating or something that hurts so good type thing.
So you're asking
him
to make the decision based on his pleasure.
He needs to tell me what makes him pleasurable.
I have to say, a dildo does not necessarily vibrate. I would call that a vibrator.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, you're
so
right.
That's
right.
A good question. We should ask him specifically.
Can I be honest? Can we reread the question? Once I heard butt play, I was like, my brain started to be like, well, my mind was blown that someone actually referenced one of our prior episodes.
I'll just skip the beginning where he says he loves House of Pod, everybody. but he wanted to know, when you're engaging in ass play, which is whatever, some version of anal sex, or anal penetration, I don't know. Would you recommend, he wrote specifically, a dildo or a fist. So, you know, let's just assume it's a non-vibrating thing, because we all know fists, all things being equal, let's not compare apples and oranges today.
One question I have, though, is I don't understand why us or you doctors would have any sort of insight on that question.
Oh, that's something I can speak to. Well, actually, Lizzie can
speak to
if
that's what this person is asking. Yeah. Is he asking which one's more pleasurable or which one's safer?
I'm assuming it's safer, or he wouldn't ask us.
Yeah, the pleasure component, you don't
that's
ask
how I was responding to it.
That at all.
I was thinking the pleasure. Well, it depends. If you want something that hurts a little more.
I feel like, Joe, you're teasing this apart way too much. Let's just say, if you're going to put something up your ass, let's say, which is safer, a dildo or a fist?
Depends on the size of the
dildo. I think this is pretty clear. I think, first of all.
Chikabe is like this. I have the answer, you guys.
First of all. They both can be dangerous if you're not careful.
Right.
All right. We've talked about that. You don't want things getting lost in there, and you don't want to use things that are past the size you are equipped to deal with. But I would say I think a fist is probably much more dangerous than a dildo, assuming the dildo is of like a reasonable girth and size.
Oh, see, I was going to say, yes, what you're saying is true. If the dildo is small, I guess a fist would be more... dangerous, but I was thinking things that were the same size, and I was like, someone else's fist would be able to detect maybe an impending.
Talking
about.
I do not recommend
a perforation
size dildo. I do not recommend that.
I said I was gonna say an impending perforation. So this
let's
is what
make
we're talking
this real
about.
Simple.
Oh my God, my
Dr.
parents
Jafrida,
are listening to this.
Dr. Jafrida is gonna make the final call.
Yeah.
I would tell the patient, well, why don't you just try it slowly and feel it out. No pun intended. Feel it out. you know, when you're
I think
using,
going slow is a good
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, go slow. You know your pain tolerances and just feel it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
End of story. Next question.
No, hold on.
Joe's like, I'm batting these things away right and left. I got this down. Next question.
I have to make this clear. Either one of these things can be dangerous if it's not done safely. So we have to preface it by saying that first.
Well, what is safely?
Well, again, we're talking about a complication. I have had a patient who told me that he had a perforation of a colon from a play, from aggressive ass play. And, you know, I didn't ask specifically if it was a fist or a dildo or a vibrator or the size of anything. So, yeah, I mean, anything can have a risk to it. So you have to be careful. And I agree, going slowly sounds smart with anything. And as far as doctors or quote unquote experts in this, you know, there's no data. I haven't looked it up, but I should, but we're not going to have data on this, you know? So it's hard to, I guess he's asking our professional advice, but yes, if it's very, very big, very, very tall, it can more likely cause a tear, a perforation.
Please be careful.
I think you guys CYA'd yourself enough. We're good. Next question.
Listen, you don't just tell us to go to the next question.
I'm trying to test my authority here.
Stretching your wings a little bit.
Yeah. Remember, I am the producer. I'm
you
on
are
the show.
A producer. Not the producer.
Lizzie mentioned a power trip, but I didn't really say anything. But deep down, it's starting to, I'll admit, in my head, there's a power struggle.
A struggle.
I kind of like doing all the crap that I whine about, all the editing. Gives me power.
Your producer, your editor, your co-host, and now your expert on fisting.
Correct.
And I think that wraps it up.
Thank you guys so much for all the emails, and please keep them coming, hopquestions@gmail.com. Please call us as well and leave a voicemail, 408-444-6623. Thank you to Nadeem Abubaker, one of the producers, and thanks for listening.
all anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.